As we enter this fall season of challenge, Liz, Edmund, and I are sharing the sermon tonight to open up a focus for this season, which is to open up a space of questioning related to her sermon prompt about what it is to imagine queer in relationship to church and queer in relationship to Christianity. And this is something that has been core to St. Lydia's since its beginnings. And in fact, as Emily Scott prepared to leave St. Lydia's in 2016, 2017, she preached a series of sermons around foundations for St. Lydia's. We are, and then six different words. We are Lutheran. We are a dinner church. And one of those six sermons was, we are queer. And during this fall season of challenge, I am inviting the congregation, along with Liz, to imagine how to step deeper into those questions. What does it mean that we have claimed that we are queer church? It's certainly more than the fact that we have members who identify as lesbian or gay or bisexual or transgender or some other place on the spectrum of gender and sexual diversity. It's something more about how we understand what it is to be church and what it is to be Christian. So Liz and I will go back and forth tonight, just opening up some space around questions that are articulated in a series of whys. Now I want to start with the question, why queer? Why do we care about queer? And I want to start very personally about why I care about queer. And I was struck by this past Saturday, Megan Rohr being ordained a bishop in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Megan is the first transgender bishop in any denomination, and certainly in the Lutheran Church. And they were ordained in the Sierra Pacific Synod, which is the synod that surrounds the greater San Francisco area. And Megan grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, went to Augustana College, and recalls just a lot of abuse, a lot of harassment as they grew up and found themselves. And then, interestingly, claimed a sense that, no, like, you're all wrong. All you people attacking me, you're wrong. God loves me. I'm God's beloved. And so they went off to seminary at my seminary, Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary in Berkeley, to explore this more deeply and to say, what does it mean that I claim that God calls me beloved as I am? And they became a pastor, and eventually, as the ELCA accepted queer candidates for ministry in 2009, they became a regular called pastor to a congregation, and then just this past year were elected bishop. And I was thinking back to my own experience as I started seminary just after the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America was formed. And it was formed at a time when there was kind of a don't ask, don't tell approach to queer people being called to ministry. And just before I arrived, three candidates who had graduated from seminary, been approved by the church for calls to congregations, all publicly came out together and said, oh, by the way, we're gay. And there was just a firestorm in the church, and especially in the church headquarters in Chicago. And when I arrived, my first fall in seminary, I arrived with a new document that had been produced by the church headquarters called Sexual Expectations for Candidates for Ministry in the ELCA, which basically ruled out anyone who wasn't heterosexual and married as potential candidates for ordination unless they vowed celibacy. That was the openness, if you will, a very closed frame. And so I watched my classmates who were queer grappling with this. Do I lie? Do I stay hidden in order to get through the process? Do I have integrity to myself and drop out? Do I switch to a Master's of Arts in Religion instead of a Master of Divinity, which prepares me for ministry? And so I ended up doing my master's thesis on a very critical examination of the Lutheran teaching on marriage and on homosexuality, and arguing for gay marriage as a positive thing, as a thing that the Lutheran tradition and the Christian tradition could bless and accept. And in this lesson from Paul tonight, he talks about listening to another gospel. And people wrote to me and said, "You're listening to another gospel. Like, you're listening to the wrong voices because of what you're saying publicly about queer people in the church." And so this very text that we have tonight was used to rebuke me, to other me, to try and shut me up, if you will, as someone speaking out in behalf of my colleagues who are queer and trying to find a way forward in the church. So very early in my life, in my public career, I said, queer identity, queer life in the church is going to be a place where I stand and fight. And so it's such a delight for me to be pastor at St. Lydia's, where this is something that we stand on as a congregation, that we claim as a part of our coordinates, as our identity, as our foundation, as a congregation. And I'm so excited for this fall to explore more deeply what that might mean for us. And so I'll pass the baton to Liz to say, like, not just queer, but why queer church? What does queerness have to do with church? Liz?
Thank you, Christian. And oh, my God, what a powerful story. I mean, you didn't say that last night, you know, that this very text had been used against you. At some point, I'll talk about how during the height of the AIDS pandemic, I was disinvited from preaching at a Methodist church about my ministry in HIV/AIDS, because if I couldn't say that I was celibate, it wasn't okay for me to ascend the pulpit. So whole conversations that get wiped out because of anxiety about these very issues. So in our series of why questions, my question, as Christian has said, is why church? And I have two thoughts about this to share with you. Why church? One is, first of all, I want to just express my admiration to folks who really took on the question of why queerness. I don't know what was going on in the other group, and I sort of wish I could have been a fly on the wall listening to everybody. But I will tell you that in my table, we had an extraordinary conversation, and I listened to several beautifully nuanced takes on queerness and people's experience of queerness. And we did this interesting sort of historical move, you know, folks like giving voice to what it was back in the day when queer was used as sort of an attack on anybody who was different. And it didn't have to do with sexuality necessarily, but you'd get attacked for that. And then moving on through sort of like, okay, that's not the issue that I faced, but, you know, kind of an exploration of what queerness might be. I have to talk about this a lot because when I'm out speaking about queer virtue, it's one of the questions that people always ask. You know, how are you using the word queer? Thank you. And one of the really interesting things that I think church communities, this takes people by surprise, and it always takes me by surprise that it takes them by surprise, but what we have done in the past 30 or 40 years with the word queer is to invert it. You take this concept that is loaded. We're queering the recording process. Here we go. Okay. So what queer folk have done is taken this concept that once upon a time was loaded with violence and shame and inverted it to become a source of pride. And the reason that Christians should get that is because that's exactly what Christianity has done with the image of the cross. The image of the cross starts as a violent image, just saturated with shame. And early Christians flip that over precisely as an expression of liberation. We will not be bound by the shame. And there is something in the violence here that's been directed at this that is part of what we are here to counter in our work. So there's this connection, this essential connection here between queerness and Christianity. And that's one reason that it matters for us as a church to be talking about queerness and our faith. You know, it's really, it is rare for Christian communities anymore to remember what we did with the cross, to remember that particular inversion. So it is important for us as a church to remember that inversion and actually to talk about it. So that's one reason that I think why queer church is important. The second reason is because we are a church. that's who we are, you know? And our work as a church has everything to do with figuring out who we are when we come together. You know, because St. Lydia's is, you know, we often skew a little younger. We are, you know, we're way more progressive. And it's easy, I think, to sort of wander into the doors of St. Lydia's on kind of on our own individual searches for ethics, for identity, for meaning. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a really important part of our process. It's a valuable journey. But it is incomplete. There are the reasons that people join a church, it's more than that, you know? And one of the things that we'll do over the course of this conversation that we're about to have is not take for granted what we mean in any, when we're talking about any of this stuff, when we're talking about queerness or even what the nature of church. But let's just think for just a moment about the purpose of church, the purpose of Christian community. And fundamentally, what I would say is that we come together in shared purpose. So for instance, we might come together to journey together, to offer one another care and support. We come together to offer care and support to the rest of the world, to our neighbors, for instance. We come together to worship God, or put another way, to touch transcendent reality, transcendent presence, transcendent truth, to touch that together. And as a church, part of our job is to witness to that truth, that presence, that reality to others. We come together as a church to bring healing, justice, and love to a world that desperately needs all of these things. Now, we are a Christian community. We just broke bread. We're doing communion. Like, we're talking the talk here, which means that St. Lydia's is part of a complicated tradition, a difficult tradition, and a tradition that we all know has done its share, more than its share of damage to the world. So what we're going to do over the next few weeks is queer that tradition. We're going to work as a church to name what it is in this tradition and faith that we really can believe, a faith that we can witness together in words and in actions, and not just sort of feel good about that, but really want to do that out in the world. Okay, final thought, because we are a church, It really matters that we speak from and with our tradition's sacred text, AKA the Bible. So we've just started by reading the first verses of Galatians, and that is what we are going to read for the rest of this season. Christian, why Galatians?
Well, it's interesting that in the life of the progressive Christian church, Paul has become quite a problematic figure. He's viewed as homophobic, saying that same-sex relationships are an abomination to God. Mm-hmm. He's viewed as sexist, saying that women should be quiet in church, that they should be subject to their husbands. He's viewed as racist, saying that slaves should be subject to their masters. So there's a whole set of things which make Paul, as a major representative in the canon, in the like received Bible that we have, as a kind of a difficult figure. Like, what do we make of him? And there's been a effort over the last 30 years in academic scholarship to put Paul in the context of the Roman Empire, to seek for some different perspectives about Paul that open him up. And as we were thinking about this series this fall, one of the things that most drew us to this particular book is the way in which his depiction in what it means to be one in Christ in the third chapter of Galatians opens up this perspective about queering Christianity, like breaking down or dismantling the status quo, these categories which society assigns us, which divide us. And that is where he says in chapter 3, there is no longer Jew nor Greek, there is no longer slave nor free, there is no longer male nor female, for we are all one in Christ. And we were curious about that. Like, what is it in this letter to the churches in Galatia, whatever that means, that Paul would center in his message this dismantling of categories which divide us? And so we thought, okay, so this is a space in Scripture for us as a church to grapple with what we receive from Jesus about a radical welcome, a welcome that sets aside the categories that divide us, that sets aside the categories that say who's welcome and who's not, who has authority and who does not, who has a right to be at the table and who does not. And so Galatians is going to be a place for us to grapple and to ask the question, can we find a Paul that helps us in this journey of queering Christianity? And there's a particular way that we're opening up this experience of Paul through a particular scholar Liz has been inspired by, and I have also been inspired by. So Liz, why this particular scholar to help us open up Paul?
I want to ask first, show of hands, how many of y'all feel like you have like any kind of sense of Paul, like who he was, why he's like part of this whole story? Yeah, right? Anybody? Right? Okay. See, it kills me that, you know, the prompt last night was, what's your relationship to Paul? And you could just feel it, like this kind of depth. But what's your relationship to queerness? We've all got something to say about that. Which is another answer to the question, why church? But I want to just talk for, everything Christian that you just said about Paul is spot on. And because I don't really work with the clobber passages, and I hadn't even been thinking about the fact that a number of the clobber passages are attributed to Paul, right? So it's like super counterintuitive. Okay, so let's just place Paul really quickly here and talk about why he matters in the tradition. Okay. I mean, it's fair to ask, why are we reading one of the epistles? So many churches, especially progressive churches, don't do the epistles at all. Why are we not reading one of the gospels? Why aren't we reading, you know, judge not that you be not judged. Love your neighbor as yourself. You know, all that good, like Jesus lovey-dovey stuff. Like, why not read that? Okay. We're going to do a quick, short thing. Here's what happens in the gospels. The gospels tell a story about a ragtag group that comes together to proclaim hope and liberation and spiritual accountability in the face of imperial power and imperial coercion. At the center of this movement was a figure who beat the Roman death machine by surrendering to it. Now, this is a fascinating story, but what do we do with that? You know, like, what is a community that wants to be part of that? How do you access that? What does that even mean? What do we, right? Okay. Paul is the guy who takes this story and brings it to communities and then helps them figure out what that means. Helps them figure out what to do with it. And all the epistles that we now consider to be part of the Bible, that are part of the Bible and that many people consider sacred text, those letters are letters that he wrote to these communities to help them continue to grapple with the crazy kind of wackadoodle story that they're hearing about this guy who's killed by Rome and comes back from the dead and has these beautiful ethical teachings. Paul's whole mission was to help us figure out how to live this faith. As Christian mentioned, Paul is kind of a troubling character, like Christianity itself, kind of difficult. And it's really common for progressive Christians just to ignore him, you know? Who needs to deal with the complexity of this guy who seems to have written these horrible things? So I want to tell you a quick story. When I was 12, I came across the word savvy for the first time. I saw it written down. So I went to my mother, oh, two V's, I thought that was great. Went to my mother and I'm like, what does that mean? And she, yes. So I go to my mother and I say, what does this mean? And she like does the whole like, oh, it's from the French savoir faire, you know, and it means like somebody who's like knows a lot, you know, like kind of like, you know, is like hip to what's really going on, savvy. And I said to my mother, I love this idea, but it's kind of an ugly word coming out of your mouth. I think I'm going to pronounce it savvy. And my mother said, you can pronounce it any way you want, but nobody will know what you're talking about. If we as a church are serious about queering Christianity, we have to come to terms with Paul. Because if we don't, the people who are fluent in Paul will not know what we're talking about. He's too central to the tradition and to the whole concept of what it is to be a church, simply to ignore. Now, fortunately, as Christian said, we've got a wonderful guide that we're going to be working with this season. Brigitta Call is a professor at Union Theological Seminary. She is not a wackadoodle. And she takes on this question. Here's a question she's grappling with. Paul hung out with the same people that Jesus hung out with. They never met. Paul and Jesus never met. Paul has his conversion experience after Jesus has ascended into heaven, but Jesus's followers are still there and they're hanging out with the same people. So the question becomes, how is it that so much of what Paul wrote comes to be used to justify causes that are directly opposing so much of what Jesus taught? And Call, she just wants to explore this. I want to be really clear about this. Call is not, she's not a Paul apologist. She's not trying to defend Paul. She's not trying to save Paul. She's not, none of that. She just wants to know what happened. So she looks at Roman society. What was going on in Rome at the time? She specifically looks at Roman art to sort of get like sort of the messages that are permeating the airwaves. And this is a commentary on the book of Galatians. She wants to know who the Galatians were. And she's looking at Roman art that portray Galatians. Turns out, see, you know, most of Paul's letters are directed to cities, the letters to the Corinthians, right? Corinth, Thessalonica, Ephesus. Well, we don't know if he wrote that one. But anyway, Galatia is not actually a city. The Galatians were a people. They were spread all over Western Europe. They are the ancestors to the Celts and the Gauls and all those people, right, who were like throughout Western Europe. And specifically, the Galatians were a warrior tribe who fought vigorously against Roman oppression and Roman occupation. And again and again and again, Roman armies beat the Galatians to a bloody pulp. And that's what a lot of the art is that Brigitte Kahl is looking at. All the Roman ideology about the Galatians being crushed, you know. But they kept at it. So they were a natural community for Paul to reach out to in this effort to get people to rethink, what does liberation mean? How is that possible? How does Roman law keep us from being able to find liberation? So those are Kahl's questions. And interestingly, as she sort of like peers back and begins to sort of like dissolve the layers of accretion in art, there's this idea of accretion where it is this stuff that covers a painting and covers it. And as it gets older and older and older, conservators have to actually peel off layers in order to get to the real painting. And as she does that historically, she begins to hear a message from Paul that is remarkably resonant with all the messages that are super familiar to us coming from Jesus in the Gospels. Kahl argues basically that Paul was the victim of identity theft. That's what she says. That his message simply could not stand under Roman. Once Christianity becomes the imperial religion, his message just simply can't stand. And she says this: long after his encounter with the risen Christ on the road to Damascus, Paul underwent a second conversion in the Christian imagination, one that turned him posthumously into the mouthpiece of the very imperial order that centuries earlier had executed him as enemy and other. There are parallels between Paul's message being warped and corrupted then and Christianity being warped and corrupted today. How did Christianity become a weapon of virulent anti-Semitism? How did Christianity become a tool of white supremacy? Calling out false binaries that have been perpetuated for millennia, Kahl will help us understand this history and queer it. She'll help us begin to envision a more radical, more authentic, and far healthier Christian faith. So, Christian, final question. Why St. Lydia's?
So, in this passage, Paul says to the churches of Galatia, it's who he addresses the letter to, two particular congregations. And he uses this Greek word for churches. The word is ekklesia in Greek. And I just want to close by acknowledging like the stakes that he's playing with in using this word. It was in Greek political culture, the name for the civic assembly, of which only certain people qualified, men who were privileged, who owned property or land. It's very similar to the early days of the American Republic. The men who had say in the founding of our country were land-owning white men. Same with this early Greek notion of ekklesia, and Paul is flipping that on its head and saying, no, actually, for the followers of Jesus, the ecclesia, the assembly, is especially those who have been left out, those who have not had a place, those who have been on the margins, who have been hurt by their dismissal. They are the ones who make up this civic assembly convened by the God we know in Jesus. So I just want to grapple with that question, like, how do we understand ourselves as church? Who gets in? What does it mean for us to be a particular assembly convened in the freedom that we receive in Jesus Christ and his articulation of this liberating God? And I think Paul is opening that up very, very early in this letter, in the second verse. All the brothers and sisters with me to the churches of Galatia. So what if he said, all the brothers and sisters with me to the churches in Brooklyn? Who are we as churches in Brooklyn? Who is in our assembly? And how do we gather people, especially those who have been left out of gatherings, of spaces of power and decision making? We share the sermon at St. Lydia's, even unusual sermons like this, where we've already been sharing back and forth. So we'll spend just a moment in silent reflection and then invite a few of you to offer stories and experiences you have inspired by the text and are grappling with it and grappling with the opening of this fall season of challenge. Our practice is to welcome reflections without praising them or criticizing them, and to invite voices who often share to consider stepping back, and those who don't very often share to consider stepping forward, so that we hear a diversity of voices over time, and by doing that, learn more deeply about one another in community. So hold silence with me for just a moment, and then when you hear the bell, you're invited to share.